Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Volt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, A Death in the Dry River by Lisa Allen Agostini, and my most recent book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. You can also support the show by buying us a cup of coffee at ko-fi.com/witchlitpodcast. Wren Jones lives in the Sonoran Desert with her family and two cats. Like most writers, she has been a storyteller for a long time. After her daughter was born, true crime felt a little too true, and darker fiction felt a little too dark. She started reading cozy mysteries, and after a while, she figured a little dose of fantasy and bi rep was what she was missing. She figured what better time to research, write, and launch a novel that she'd been procrastinating on than while working full-time and raising a tiny human. So here we are. Her latest book is Practical Potions and Premeditated Murder, out now. Wren Jones, welcome to Witchlit.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah. Thanks for reaching out and sending me your lovely book to read. So and we will get to talk about that. But our first question for everyone is, and maybe this is a good question for you as a new parent, like, you know, why still write? Why write books?
Why write books? So I've been a writer since I was a little kid, and basically wanted to be an author since I knew that that was a thing that existed. But you know, I'm in my 30s now, and this is my first book that I've published. So, you know, I've been working so much and like doing other things like raising humans and stuff like that. So I've just decided that it was time to go after my dream in a very earnest way. And I think that my bio kind of says it all. Like, I wanted to write the book that I wanted to read. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, having some representation that mattered to me and just to kind of, you know, make my little space in there. So it's, I would say it's a lifelong dream, but I decided to finally get after it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I also love to read cozies. Mm-hmm. I find that when I sit down to write, someone invariably dies in a bad way and they're no longer cozy. Also, I can't make my characters not swear. So how is that going from being like a cozy reader to someone who actually read less cozy stuff before to writing cozies? What was that like?
Yeah, it was actually really different for me. I had to be very purposeful. There is a scene where, you know, they find the body. And my first draft of that was like gnarly. You know, I was used to writing more like kind of, you know, darker fiction in my previous, I've written many, many books and this is the first one I've published, but like all my other books were much more angsty and, you know, dark fantasy. And so going from loving true crime and like writing and reading dark stuff to having my daughter and being like, oh, I don't love this anymore. Yeah. I started reading cozies and I'm like, okay, I love that we're able to still have some of those like themes without having the dark nature of it. Mm-hmm. So it was a challenge. I had to go through several drafts of this book in order to make it that cozy feel.
Yeah.
Because it really started out a little dark. It's hard to make a death happen and have it not be kind of scary.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, the cozies have such a, like a, kind of a hard line trope wise, like you can't have the death on the page really, unless it's bloodless, you know, right. you can't have characters who swear, there's no death, there's no sex on the page, you know, there's, you know, all of those things. And then I think it's interesting. I interviewed T. Thorne Coyle, who writes very queer cozies. And I love the idea that there is now this market for queer cozies, because that also used to kind of be part of the line for cozies, is that, you know, everybody had to be like upstanding straight people.
Yeah, it was always, I think, like, you know, cis, white, straight. And that was like the cozy, you know, because that's the people who are writing it and, you know, they write themselves. And like you said, in order to be cozy, people expect a certain thing. So I think it's really cool that like the queer community is carving a space out within the cozy as well. And I think it goes hand in hand because, you know, as a queer person myself, like it's hard sometimes to find books where it's not a coming out story or like where there is some kind of violence, like, or, you know, oppression mm-hmm. against someone because of their sexuality. Mm-hmm. And so I'm loving the queer cozies because you get that like, you know, homey feeling and, you know, everything fades to black and it's nice and easy. And you just get to be in that space in a safe mm-hmm. way. So I'm really loving that that's becoming a thing now.
Yeah. And I think it, what you said about like, you know, there was definitely a time when queer books were either about the struggle or unfortunately the queer character died. Mm-hmm. Like that was the trope, right? Like it mm-hmm. was always sad. And to have like queer representation across genre and including cozies where everything gets tied up with a bow at the end and, you know, life moves on and no one has PTSD from the fact that someone was murdered in their tiny town. You know,
exactly.
It's like, yeah, like, you know, everyone deserves to have that.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone deserves to have that feeling of safety and security. And like you said, with the PTSD aspect, you know, like if you like the vibe of cozy, I think part of it is because you kind of like that true crime aspect. Mm-hmm. You like the, you know, a little bit of thrill, but you know, at the end, everyone's going to be safe and no one's going to have like, you know, horrific nightmares waking up and, you know, there was a dead body. It's just like, okay, you know, we're back to serving tea and, mm-hmm. you know, cookies, and it's just, it's a nice space for them to, I think, feel safe and seen.
Yeah. So one of the things for folks who haven't read the book, mm-hmm. Like I feel like a lot of the witchy cozies I've read are set like in made up towns mm-hmm. in Maine. I don't know why, but that seems to be the like the cozy central of ones I've read recently. Mm-hmm. Or one of my favorite series is actually a witch who lives on a narrowboat in London, which is one yeah. of my favorite queer or witchy cozy series. But mm-hmm. I think this was really different because you world build from scratch for this mm-hmm. book. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, so I wanted it to kind of be like, I've read witchy cozies, fantasy or cozy mysteries. But I wanted to really be more considerate about marrying the cozy fantasy with cozy mystery. So like really bringing in those aspects of cozy fantasy that people like and putting it into like kind of a melding of genres, which I know is nothing new, but I wanted to be very intentional about mm-hmm. like world building and creating like, you know, these different, you know, fictional creatures that come into play and things like that. And so in book two, there's a lot more world building. This was kind of just like a little taste of it, but mm-hmm. yeah, I wanted it to feel unique and yeah. like a little bit different than what you may be used to, the main mm-hmm. cozy witch, you know? So
yeah.
Yeah, it was fun to world build from scratch. It was a good time.
Yeah. And I like that humans are from across the sea, like these yes. kind of exotic creatures from yeah, across the
for
sea.
Them, they're like humans are the, ooh, like there's a human in town. So interesting, mm-hmm. you know, and I thought that was a fun way to take it. So instead mm-hmm. of, you know, kind of like these more fey creatures being the unusual ones, it's like mm-hmm. ooh, a human.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed that dynamic in the book. Well, and I'm excited to hear there's more world building in the second mm-hmm. book. Because there were definitely things I was like, I want to know more about that.
Yes.
yeah. So obviously you kind of had this epiphany about like what you wanted to write and how you wanted to do that. So what made you make the decision to go with self-publishing?
So, I mean, I was just watching all these other self-published authors like actually create success and like, you know, really make a name for themselves. So one of my biggest inspirations was Rebecca Thorne, who wrote Can't Spell Treason Without Tea. And just seeing like how kind of beautiful it was that she was able to have like her own space and help other people through mm-hmm. the journey of self-publishing. I was like, this is so cool. And I love the, I guess like non-competitive nature of self-publishing, like, mm-hmm. you know, for traditional publishing, I feel like there's a lot of competition and other writers, you see them more as like, you know, ooh, if I don't get this, they'll get this. And if they get this, I don't get this. With indie spaces, I feel like we're always just cheering for each other and supporting each other. Mm-hmm. And like when one person finds success, it's like, great, now go read this person's stuff. It's really good. And we're just like constantly helping each other out. And it was just a place that I felt more like I was able to like be in, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. That's just my nature. I'm a really cooperative person, and I'm a really like, I want to help other people as much as I can. And so seeing that happen, I was like, okay, this is the space that I think I can be in.
Yeah. And no, that makes sense.
Yeah. Not to rant too much, but like, you know, I think when we were younger too, like self-publishing had kind of a negative like stereotype mm-hmm. to it. Like, oh, yeah. You did a vanity publishing or something. But yeah. Now since you're able to do so much of it yourself and it's cool research and things like that, it has a different connotation to it now.
Yeah. I mean, I still hear some, you know, tittering about, mm-hmm. oh, vanity publishing. I'm like, yeah, well, vanity publishing was really, you spend a lot of money to have someone else publish your book. And this mm-hmm. one is you spend a lot of money to publish your own book.
Mm-hmm. It is. Yeah. You spend a lot of money. I had to budget pretty extensively to make this happen. I mean, you know, the ISBNs are money, the cover's money, all the stuff, but you know, it's so much research too, to figure out how to do it all yourself. And so it kind of feels like very much an accomplishment when you're done to be like, oh wow. Like I have so much knowledge now. Yeah. And it's kind of neat. I'm always learning. So like, yeah. It was a good thing for me to exercise my brain in that way.
Yeah. I feel like there's never not something new to figure out and come along. Like one of the things I was talking about, I have a message thing with some writer friends, and I was like, oh, have you seen KDP change the rules about the keywords? And I was like, well, we don't publish through KDP, but we do have books on Amazon. So now we have to go and look at that and figure it out. And it's just like, yeah, like, you know, in everyone else's world, their publisher handles that. And in your world, you do it all yourself.
Yep. You're constantly learning. And like you said, like things are always changing with like, how does Amazon, you know, how's the algorithm work? How does mm-hmm. this work and stuff? So you're just, it's a constant learning. Yeah. And, you know, I think about traditional publishing a lot and I'm like, wow, wouldn't that be nice if I just had a publisher do this for me?
Yeah, but I mean, I feel like even folks I know who traditionally published, like mm-hmm. that, the days of like flying you around the country on a book tour kind of over, like, you know, it's,
yeah,
you do a lot of your own marketing, either through social media or, you know, setting up your own book tour, even if you're with a publisher, you know, I feel like there's a lot, I don't know that it's less support. I mean, maybe that's the right word, but I feel like there's less back-end marketing even yeah. with traditional publishers than there used to be.
That's what I've heard. Yeah. From people who have traditionally published, they're their own marketing team anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and, I don't know. It's amazing to me. Like I don't want to be too discouraging. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there still is this like weird, like from traditional publishing, like even though they make money on genre, like romance is keeping the doors open at most publishers, you know, like, so I do think there's still this like, oh, self-publishing is like all these people who write genre. And I'm like, I personally have a hard time saying that genre is not also literature, because I mean, look at Poe, like he practically right. invented the genres that we write in, so, in English anyway. So there's like, yeah, it's just funny to me that genre, like there's the dual stigma of writing genre and writing, you know, self-publishing. I think it's going away, but you still hear like the dying rasps of it, I guess.
Oh yeah. It's like the death throes, you know, of like, this is not real literature. I'm an English teacher by day and I teach like international baccalaureate at my school. So like mm-hmm. we have all of these like amazing authors and genres, and how to read that as mm-hmm. literature is really interesting, because it is. And we can learn something from every genre. And like you mm-hmm. said, oh, you know, yeah. before he came on the scene, you didn't have a lot of that. So
yeah. And I feel like there's so much room in genre fiction to talk about things that, like, you know, what's considered literary fiction. Mm-hmm. Margaret Kiljoy described literary fiction as books about white people cheating on each other. And I was like, I mean, for a long time, that was really what it is. I mean, thankfully that's diversified, but I feel like there's a lot, you know, genre is just open to talk about everything. I mean, science fiction has historically been a lot of political writing.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think it's just interesting to me that there's still this little bit of like, meh. I'm like, yeah, y'all need to read more genre.
Yeah, no, science fiction has been paving the way to talk about all kinds of, like, you know, things that need to be talked about in our current environment. And like just speculative fiction in general, I think is so interesting. You have like The Handmaid's Tale, which is now very renowned, and that's speculative fiction, like dystopia, you know?
Yeah.
And it has something to say. And I feel like fantasy, I've been reading since I was a kid, it's always had something to say.
Yeah.
You know, we just have to be open-minded to it. But, you know, some of the older generation, I think, are very much like, oh, you read about dragons. And it's like, oh, it's also got a lot of commentary on our society today, too.
You just like hoarding wealth and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. So. Like, it's an allegory.
Nice. Yeah. No, that's awesome. Well, so do your students know that you've published a book?
No, no. I did have a really funny instance, though, because it is in our library at school. You know, my librarian found out about it through some teacher friends who found me on TikTok. And so he was like, oh, I want to get it stocked. I'm like, okay, sure. Like, but, you know, don't like advertise it or anything. So I was like, yeah, well, I'll donate 2 copies to the library. And one of my fellow English teachers was like, guess who I saw reading your book in class? And I'm like,
wow, that's gotta be like your incognito at work. That's gotta be kind of fun.
It is. It's kind of fun. You know, it's a little different because, you know, it is a pen name. So a lot of people don't know about it. But yeah, I was walking down the hall one day and a fellow teacher goes, Ren Jones. I'm like, yes. She's like, I found you on TikTok. I'm like, oh, okay. Cool.
Nice. I mean, I haven't had students in a long time. But it was always, there is always that like line I had, when my first book came out, I was still in East Tennessee and I had, an acquaintance put me in touch with a school to come and talk.
Yeah.
And I was a little nervous because I'm like, you know, I'm in a relatively conservative part of the world. Right. And, are very conservative in some ways. And, my first book has, you know, like a bi character who's maybe a serial monogamist, maybe. I mean, that's not really the right word for her. She's just kind of polyamorous, but maybe ethical non-monogamy is the word for her, even though I kind of hate that phrase. So I was like, these are high school kids. Mm-hmm. Would they even be allowed to read this book? Would it even be in their library?
Right.
You know, like it was just kind of a weird thing. So I picked a very... because they wanted me to read and then talk about writing and then, you know, all that. And I was like, okay, so how do I pick like the most vanilla portion of this book to read? And, but it was, it was a great experience. And I'm sure you see this in your students. Like they are so hungry to talk to someone who's actually doing what they want to do that it was like, they were just delightful. It was so delightful to talk with them.
I'm sure that was really inspirational for them. Cause like you said, like when they see somebody who has actually gone after their dreams, I think it's really, that's impactful for them.
Yeah. So do you, like with your teaching, like, and you said that, you know, in the International Baccalaureate program, obviously they do read a lot of genres. So is there, has it kind of changed how you think about how you talk to your students about books at, now that you've published and all of that, or is it just kind of like a wash?
No, a little bit, I think, you know, because you have to be so intentional with, you know, what you are putting out in the world. Cause I've, like I said, I've written a bunch of like completed books, but this one that I was actually publishing, like, okay, I have to like go through all the revisions and the drafts and like everything is intentional. And so I come at it from a little bit of a different perspective in that, like, okay, when we're, you know, doing deep reading on these things, like why is the author doing what they're doing? Like things are intentional. And we do that for film as well with IB, which is really fun. So it's like, you know, everything that the camera focuses on is a decision that people are making. Why are they making this choice? And so I do come at it from, I guess, a little bit of a different perspective now that I've actually published. But for the most part, it's relatively the same.
Yeah, that's fun. Yeah, no, international baccalaureate programs, I think, are great, too. Yeah. Our daughter went through one. She did the program where you go off to school in another country.
Wow.
And did it,
so awesome.
Yeah. So I guess, so you said there's more world building in book 2. So that makes me think book 2 is possibly underway.
It is, yes. So it's underway. I should have it released probably around the time this podcast comes out. So October. Yeah, kind of, you know, that's a good time for the cozy, rainy, witchy, yeah. The book is underway.
I love that your, do you say Mara? Is that how you pronounce the name of the town?
Mara.
Mm-hmm. It has this like very rainy Pacific Northwest vibe.
Yes. I lived in Seattle for a few years. So it was like, it's what I wanted Seattle to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause she makes coffee and No, that's great. So do you find the second book like is like a whole new process, or do you feel like you have carried over from the first book, or is it just feel like, do I even know how to do this?
Honestly, it's so much harder than the first one because, you know, I'm like, how do I reintroduce the characters? Cause it's all the same characters. They're not traveling anywhere really. And so it's like, okay, I'm going to work under the assumption that people probably read the first book, but maybe they didn't, you know? So, cause with cozy mysteries, you can kind of hop in and out. So it's just a tricky balance to be like, okay, I don't want my readers to be bored in the first couple of chapters, but I don't want people who haven't read the first book to be totally lost.
That's such a fine line to walk. It's like
it is.
To not info dump for readers who know what you're talking about and not to leave new readers like completely in the dark.
Who is this? There's a ghost? What? Like,
Yeah,
exactly. So I second book so hard.
Well, it's me. So I am currently writing book 7 and 8. Simultaneously, which I don't recommend, especially since one is nonfiction and one's fiction. But like, I'm still at that point. Like, do I even know what I'm doing? Like, what is going on here? Like, why did I think I knew how to write a book? You know?
Yeah. I think, you know, and you probably can speak to this more, but does the imposter syndrome ever go away? Cause I'm on book 2 and I'm like, what am I doing?
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I mean, sometimes I have real, like, not debilitating, but it can sometimes feel like that. Just like, who am I to be doing this?
Yeah.
Kind of feelings. And then sometimes I'm like, I look at what's out there in the world and I'm like, I'm at least as good as that. It's fine.
That's very true.
Yeah. So it kind of wavers. I mean, I would like to think I don't have delusions of grandeur. I mean, maybe you have to have a little bit of it to even think to publish a book. I don't know. But
I think in order to be successful at anything, you have to have a little bit.
Yeah, I think you have a little bit of it. But I don't know what else to do at this point. Like, this is kind of my life. So I think if my imposter syndrome was that bad, I would be like, I don't know what to do.
Right. So. Yeah. No, I love that. Writing 2 books at the same time, though, how do you keep yourself organized? That sounds like a nightmare.
So they're so different. One is like very episodic. The nonfiction one is kind of like almost almanac-y in the way it's written. So it's really easy to pick it up and put it down because each section is completely unrelated to the previous one. Mm-hmm. So if I get stuck on the fiction book, I just go work on that one for a while.
There you go.
I still don't recommend it really.
Yeah. I think, probably for the next several decades in vine life, that is not where my brain will be at.
I mean, I would love to say I'm a full-time writer. But I mean, I obviously do the podcast and I do still have a job, like a contract job that I work. So, and just life has been hectic. So it's both of them have been on hold for about a month and a half. So hopefully in this next couple weeks, I'll be able to get back to it. But yeah, it's been interesting. So
that's the thing about writing. I think it requires so much mental energy that when life does get hectic and kind of crazy, it's like, even though it sounds easy to just like sit down and write, like the mental load that it takes to write something is so much that, you just got to put it away for a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I've been working on some other things. And then I have like a short story for an anthology that I finished the first draft of in the middle of all of this. I don't know how that happened. that was magic. So I think, I mean, it's, one of the things I was thinking about, and I always forget to ask fiction writers this, but I mean, obviously the title of the podcast is Witchlit and you're writing about witches. So does magic factor into your life too?
Yes. So I would say, you know, I am, it's kind of a weird thing. I'm kind of, I would say, agnostic, leaning towards like more of an atheist kind of, I don't work with like deities or anything like that. But for me, the placebo effect of ritual and magic is so strong, and it always has been for me. So I kind of come at it from a more like maybe like scientific-y, psychology sort of mindset, because psychology is my background. But, you know, like I have intentions in my morning coffee, and I use like recipes for, you know, creating feelings that I'm trying to evoke. So kind of like kitchen witchy vibes. And I've always had like, you know, if I'm going to put an intention into like an object to carry with me to like be brave, if I'm nervous about the podcast, you know, I have this ring and it will bring me more luck and courage and stuff like that. So I would say magic is like a pretty significant portion of my like life, even though I come at it from kind of a different angle than I think a lot of witches that I talk to.
Yeah. I think that it was interesting you said that, because I think it explains like one of the things I was reading in the book, and I was thinking the magic is really like her magic, the kitchen witchy magic she does, is actually quite realistic, I guess, in a lot of ways. It's like how a lot of herbalists or witches would function. And then there's this added elemental energy she has that is a little more CGI witchcraft. But like the most like, to me, like the most like fantastical magical things were really the magical beings in the book. Like the actual day-to-day magic was quite realistic, I guess, if you believe in those things. If you don't believe in those things, then that's also part of the fantasy.
But that's part of it. Yeah. But I did actually, I wanted it to feel real. And so like infusing the intention into, you know, boiling water and like adding certain herbs in order to create these feelings of like calm or energy and things like that. I think that was important for me to have, because that's how I practice magic. And then, yeah, there's that elemental aspect, which is just fun. Yeah, I would say the magical creatures are what kind of really bring in the cozy fantasy element a little bit more.
Make it a little bit. You have a ghost, more. You have a talking cat. The Nimene?
Which is, it's a little thing.
So I read that character and I was like, I have never seen this before. So is that just from the mind of Ren Jones, or is this based on a character or like a lore or anything?
No, just the mind of Ren Jones. I was just trying to think of like, what is a interesting fantasy creature that I would want to see in this world? Like I said, you know, I kind of wrote the book that I wanted to read. So I was like, what's a creature that's from the sea, but like, you know, not, and I just sort of built from the ground up this kind of magical being. And they're a fan favorite. Like the beta readers and the ARC readers were like, I love this. I'm like, oh, wow. Okay, cool.
Yeah, no, she was like, I want to know more about this person. And I don't want to give anything away, because I want to enjoy the surprise of her. But I really enjoyed that character a lot. And just like the quiet wisdom, but also like slightly, not really sinister, but like spooky a little bit too.
Yeah. And I like that you called it not quite sinister, because that's the vibe, right? It's supposed to be, the Nimene is spooky. Like there is something almost nefarious about it. You're like, you're not quite sure, should I trust this, you know, character or not? But ultimately, like the wisdom is still there. So like, just tread lightly kind of thing.
Well, and I think there's just so many elements to the book. And when we, before we started recording for listeners, we were talking about like, you know, the first book has some world building, but it's not like the, I mean, I think that's so hard when you're writing a series, is to get so caught up in world building in the first book, you forget to tell the story, which I can speak to, because I feel like my first series, that first book is a lot of information and not a lot of story. But I mean, you definitely get a story here. There is like a slow buildup to it, partly because she's reluctant. I mean, that's kind of, I think, consistent with, you know, your reluctant hero kind of trope. But like, I'm so excited to see what happens now that foundation is laid in the second book.
Exactly. Yeah. And I kind of did that very intentionally because, you know, I read so many, you know, cozies and fantasy where so much world building happens in book one and it's like almost mentally exhausting. Mm-hmm. So, like, I'm going to do a little world building here. And then, like, you know, hopefully you fall in love with the characters and the world. And then you come back for book two and there's like, okay, now I am going deeper into like the lore of this world and how the magic works and who these, you know, magical creatures are and things like that. Mm-hmm. And the slow build, I would say, like, you know, that's very tropey for cozy mysteries, you know, like the reluctant detective. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she has a slower build than, you know, I think a lot of protagonists do. And a part of that I've heard readers value is that she clearly has anxiety. Mm-hmm. And so they're like, oh, I can see myself in this. Like, she doesn't jump to be like, I'm going to be an action star. She's like,
yeah.
I need to weigh every single option. I'm so scared. Like,
yeah. Well, and to me, that feels more realistic than like, you know, amateur or homebrew detectives who are like, I'm just going to go be fearless and put myself in danger. And you're like, yeah. She's really not about that, which I really appreciate.
She is not about that life. No. And I actually, you know, reading cozies, like sometimes you're just like scratching your head at the protagonist, you know, the amateur sleuth of like, I found a dead body and the next day I adventure. And it's like, whoa, like I would not have that vibe.
Yeah. I will not name names, but I had read this cozy series for years and I had to stop because like the protagonist like actively does things, stupid things that you're like, okay, your police officer boyfriend, the detective all told you to stay out of this. And then you put yourself in this position and you got like confronted with a murderer. And now you want us to feel sorry for you. I was like, you walked into that lady, you know, like it's she's almost become like ungovernable, but in a bad way, like just,
yes,
you know, like this doesn't make sense. Like you would have get arrested for what you just did.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that can take you out of it for sure. And I've read cozies where that happens and I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to continue the series. Cause like best case scenario, you're going to get arrested. Worst case, you're going to get murdered. Like,
You're going to be next on the list.
Exactly. Yeah. Girl, have some common sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So I appreciate the reluctant hero and especially in this kind of in vibe, just cause it makes way more sense to me. So, but I'm glad your beta readers picked up on that. So how did you go about even finding beta readers since this was your first book and all that?
Yeah. Well, I built up a small TikTok following of people who were really, very engaged with, you know, my content. I was with theirs. And so once I, you know, had a completed draft, I was like, just reached out to them directly. Like, hey, do you want to beta read this? Like, and they were so kind and considerate and they said yes. And so I was like, okay, great. Like, here you go. And it was, that feedback was invaluable. So I know that there's Discords and stuff where you can find beta readers. And some people, you know, advertise that they do it on like their social medias, but yeah, for me, I was just like, you know, hey, like we've been communicating quite a bit. You can say no if you don't want to, but like, how do you feel about this? And they're like, I've excited about this book for a while. Let's do it. So
yeah, I really that's awesome. That. Yeah, I do. And I think you're right about the like indie publishing that there does seem to be this camaraderie and people want to help. And and I mean, it's like, you know, it's like you would think writers are the last people who would take time to read another book, but we all seem to be read as much as we write, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's really, it's just a beautiful thing that we're all willing to kind of help each other out. And, you know, maybe if someone is not willing to beta read, they're like, no, I can't do that, but I can do this for you. You know, like, let me read over your blurb and see how that sounds, you know, and it's just really cool that we find, oh my God, blurbs are the bane of our existence. Huh?
Yeah. I would rather write a whole book than write a blurb 100%. Easily. Yeah. No, they're terrible. Yeah. And I was like, oh, AI. And I was like, yeah. I mean, on a whim, I was like, okay, well, let's just see what ChatGPT has to say about writing a blurb. And it was terrible. And I was like, yeah, this is not working. And now that I was like, okay, because I was like, I don't want to 100% like just blow this off because I want to say I tried it. But having tried it, knowing like all of the stuff about AI, I'm like, yeah, no. And I mean, I think, you know, I personally did not have books that were scraped, but I had any friends whose names came up in those lists of books that were scraped.
Nice.
And I'm like, yeah, this feels like the wrong thing to be asking. What is the meme that's been going around? I don't want robots to, you know, make art and write poetry. I want them to do my dishes so I can write poetry and make art. No, yeah, it seems so backwards to me.
Agreed. Yeah. Like, you know, ideally we have robots and AI to do the boring things that we don't need to do and want to do. And like, you know, I would love to see like a Star Trekian universe where like, you know, we can get rid of all of these things and just focus on bettering society through science and art and music and creation. Leave all that other stuff to the AI, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's why I think it's good to see like a great pushback from artists and readers and people who consume, you know, art. I like that there's such a huge pushback with that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being a teacher, an English teacher specifically, like I have kids turn in, you know, ChatGPT essays and I'm like, I can clock immediately that a human did not write this. Like the AI isn't there yet. I hope it doesn't need to be. You know, you got to create your own ideas and your own like critical thinking skills, you know?
Yeah. I mean, at this point I was joking. I kind of have been trying not to even call it AI because it really isn't yet. It's like these large language models or whatever. But I mean, I think that that's just what it's being called and that's what everybody calls it. And I don't think I can win that.
If you have a term for it, let me know and I'll start using it.
Well, right now I just call it the plagiarism bot. It's such a weird space. And I feel like the potential for indie authors to be damaged by AI stuff is higher because they come in like the stuff that's, you know, overpopulating Amazon and things like that. They are kind of in that genre indie space, like at the price point they're charging, they're self-published, you know, and it's just garbage.
It is,
or it's just flat out plagiarism. I mean, that's the other problem. So
I mean, both is garbage, right? You know, but it is kind of dragging down, I think, a lot of indie authors. And I was talking to, I did a TikTok live with my audiobook author, and she is like a huge pioneer for the human voices only movement. Mm-hmm. So it's basically, you know, Amazon was like, hey, we'll set preying really, I feel like, on indie authors, like reach out to indie authors. We will do this audiobook for free with our AI bot. And the output is garbage. Like, you know, it doesn't have any inflection, any emotion. It can't distinguish between read and read. Mm-hmm. And then it's damaging, I feel like, that indie author, because people are going to listen to it and be like, oh, this is terrible, and not pick up the actual book.
Right.
And so, you know, it's just, it's not there. And we need to kind of acknowledge that. And I think pull away a little bit so that way it doesn't continue to damage these like small creators.
Yeah. And it was funny. I was talking at that same group yesterday and talking about the difference between doing like a human voices audiobook, which, you know, costs money and time and all of those things. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the accessibility issue of if you don't have an audiobook, you know, is AI then an accessibility thing? And I was like, part of me says yes. And part of me is like, but we already have text to voice technology that can read it. That's not being published and charged as an audiobook. Like Google can already read a book to you. That isn't an audiobook. So yeah, I have a lot of weird feelings about that one.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, to me, if you can get it for free with, you know, text to voice, you know, I feel like it's damaging from like an accessibility point to pay for an inferior product. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but that's, like you said, there's a lot of kind of, there's pros and cons to it, but I feel like ultimately it kind of is a damage. You know, and I say this as someone who, I was very fortunate. My audiobook took me a long time to publish, but I saved up money and I also did like a coffee fund. So I was like, hey, you know, like I can get you these perks if you help me out. And people were donating $25 here and there. And that helped significantly. Like I would be very challenging to do it without that. So I was fortunate that I had people come to my aid and readers who wanted the audiobook so much that they helped fund it. But, you know, I listened to the audio and she just did such a beautiful job. It would be hard to imagine a bot reading it and to get the same feeling.
Yeah. We started an audiobook project for my first book before the pandemic with a friend who had been an actress and had kind of retired from acting and then just life intervened. But I have about 2/3 of the book, and the first chapters I listened to that she recorded, I was like, this doesn't even sound like, it sounds so much better than what I wrote.
Absolutely. Like
it was just kind of, it is amazing to hear it like transferred into that other medium.
It was weird. Yeah. I thought it would feel cringe, you know, to hear my writing being read, but it almost felt like I didn't write it at all. Cause I was like, wow, you just did such a beautiful job with like these character voices. It doesn't even feel like I wrote this.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, and that's really where AI can't shine. Like, I feel like AI just cannot have that warmth that an audio narrator can have. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's plus, I mean, you know, again, with the AI read, it's, you're taking somebody's job. I mean, that's literally taking somebody's job to do that. So
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, audiobook authors or narrators, you know, that's their livelihood. Mm-hmm. And it's like with AI cover art, like you're taking an artist's job, you know, like my cover artist is phenomenal. And to think that, you know, maybe she wouldn't have the same opportunities because AI is taking over is just crappy.
Yeah. And I mean, I've seen the arguments that it's too expensive to have someone do real art. And I'm like, I'm already kind of concerned that we're calling it real art.
Right.
You know, like, yes, all of those things cost money. And I realize that for some people, there's a barrier, and that's a real barrier. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, you know, I don't know that AI art, it creates another barrier in its own way. Mm-hmm. Like you said, to artists actually getting work who also need to eat and pay rent and all those things. So it's, you know, it's a vicious cycle. And yeah, I have not 100% agreed with any of the pro AI arguments other than, oh, maybe we'll be able to use it to find new ways to treat cancer. And I'm like, great, that's how we should be using it. Let's do that.
I think that's kind of where we need to focus our energy on is like, okay, so how can we utilize AI to make our lives easier and, you know, and solve problems that take us a very long time to do that a computer can do faster. And, you know, there's, as far as like AI artists finding cover artists concerned, there's ways that you can also do it more cheaply if you use a less experienced artist or, you know, like there's definitely ways that you can, it's still a barrier because I understand if you're like paycheck to paycheck, it's very, very challenging, but like there are avenues that you can take. It's just a little bit more time and research to find them. But, you know, it's a tricky, it's nuanced, right? Like everything.
Yeah.
There's no black and white to.
Yeah. And I mean, I always like to tell people, you know, it was like, how did you do your first one? I said, well, the first one I actually did like with a little independent publishing house and then I got the rights back. But my husband had worked for Ingram and was laying out books and did graphic design and cover art. So like, you know, I lucked out that I had that in-house.
For sure.
But I mean, we pay for editing and, you know, I feel really strongly that a book has to be edited.
Oh my gosh. My developmental editor. Yeah. Invaluable.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just, you are too close to the forest to see the trees.
Absolutely.
When you write it, or you think you've put things in there that aren't there. I mean, that's really the one that I trip up. It's like, oh, I know this about this character, but I didn't tell the reader.
Right. Yeah. You have this huge backstory in your mind and you're like, these little elements are important and you think it's in there and it's not. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I, even if I will say this, especially for people who are listening, who might be interested in self-publishing, if you absolutely cannot afford to pay an editor, work with beta readers who will be honest with you.
That's the thing. Yeah. If you can't afford an editor, like I completely understand they are expensive. They really are. But yeah, beta readers are a must. Like you have to have other eyes on your book because you're too close to it.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. I was going to say, I mean, you're an English teacher and I'm sure you would not have even attempted to edit your own book.
No. Cause your mind fills in the gaps, you know what I mean? And so it's not, you can't edit your own book. Yeah.
So now that you're published and you're working on book two, so how does it feel to see that book like out in the world?
It's crazy. It's crazy. I love it. One of my favorite indie bookstores that I've been going to since I was a really small kid has my book on the shelf. Mm-hmm. And the first time I went to go look at it, it was sold out. So I was like, oh, okay. Like they're ordering more. So I was like, okay, great. So I went back weeks later and I saw it on the shelf and I'm like, oh my God, like this is crazy. It's just, it's such a feeling of accomplishment. It's really, it's quite lovely. But, you know, I try to just use that to kind of fuel me forward because, you know, it'd be easy if this was your lifelong dream to be like, I did it. But you're like, nope, the work is not done. You know?
Yeah. I feel like even getting it published is like when the work starts.
Oh yeah. Cause marketing and you know, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now working on book two, it's like, okay, got this extra load.
Yeah. Well, cool. So before we get to our last question, I'm going to give you an opportunity to tell people where they can find your book and your website or anything else you want to share. And then we'll jump into our little game of chance.
Awesome. Yeah. So, I mean, you can find my book on Amazon or it is available via audio if you're interested through Audible. And then I also have it through various bookstores. You can buy it at like Barnes & Noble. A lot of indie stores have picked it up. But if you're interested in purchasing it from your own indie bookstore, you can definitely ask for them to stock it. And a lot of them are willing to do that for you. So if you don't want to support Amazon, I completely understand, you know, it's this huge monolith and we don't have to, you know, support that. So if you're anti-Amazon, totally get it. You can buy it through your indie bookstore. Just ask them to stock it for you and they usually will.
Nice. Cool. And we'll put links to all that stuff in the show notes for folks. So our last question is a little bit of a game of chance. If you've listened to the podcast, I always joke that this is my Scorpio nature wanting to talk about stuff we're not supposed to talk about. I'm going to roll a die, and depending on what number I roll, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. And if I get a six, you get to pick which one you want, and you can pass. So let's see. Five, money. We kind of talked about this a little bit. So as an indie author, where do you hope to fall financially? Like, is break even the goal, or is it really like, are you like, I'm going to be one of those six figure indie authors?
Yeah, I feel like, gosh, I'm almost disappointed because we've already touched on money a little bit, but, you know, I guess that's my chaotic nature as well. So, I have already broken even, so I've already come out on top. And, I, like I said before, like I'm a really, I'm not a competitive person and I'm a very cooperative natured person, but in order to be my most cooperative self and help others, I need to get that six figures. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like, my dream is to make this like a big thing. So that way I can help other people. Like to me, that's what you do when you make money. Yeah. Money is a tool and you need to use it for the benefit of others. And so, yeah, for me, like me, I'm not going to lie. Like money is a motivator. I need to promote this book. I need to make money off this book. So that way I can keep helping other indie authors, helping artists, helping to, you know, further the arts as best I can.
Yeah.
And so that's a motivator.
Oh, that's awesome. That's fantastic that you broke it even already. Like, I think that, especially doing an audiobook, because that really is an outlay.
Yeah. The audiobook has been doing really well. And so I've been very grateful for that. And we do a, like a royalty share where, so like she gets half, I get half and, you know, get money. So that's a great way. If you're an indie author, usually you can get kind of a discounted price if you share the royalties.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I've sold over 1,000 books on Amazon now. I've been doing really well on Ingram Spark, which is where they send out to the bookstores.
Yeah.
So it's been doing pretty well.
That's awesome.
That's definitely my level of success, but pretty well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's always the, like the name, the author's names that, you know, and you recognize their face. Like, yeah, that's a whole different level of success. Yeah.
I have a like to be six figures, I would not like for people to stop me at a coffee shop. that's the vibe. It's the middle I'm trying to get to.
I had an interview with Kodakis, who also writes kind of witchy romance, more contemporary romance. But they introduced me to the term celebrity, which I really like.
So, I love that.
that's the grand goal to shoot for. Mm-hmm. So I guess kind of to leap off of that, just because we had talked about money, like, so you have an audiobook. If in your wildest dreams this got picked up for another adaptation, like what would you love to see?
Oh my gosh. I think I would love to see a miniseries. Mm-hmm. You know, like a movie would be so cool, but I feel like the slow burn of the first novel is definitely lends itself more to like kind of episodic series mm-hmm. rather than a movie. So like, yeah, if my wildest dreams tomorrow, I get a call from Netflix you know, and they're like, we want to do a miniseries. I'd be like, that worries me because you guys always cancel your miniseries, but yes, yeah. Let's do it.
Yeah. So who have you cast in your lead roles?
That is a great question. So I did do like a fan casting for my audiobook narrator. Mm-hmm. And the Kitchen Witch, I did as, I believe it was Julia Jones, just because she has such like a deadpan delivery on mm-hmm. things. I was like, this is perfect. And for Callie, the ghost was Rose, I want to say MacGyver, but I might be conflating the last name. She's on like iZombie and Ghosts and things like that. She just has such like a bubbly vibe to her. So that's her for sure. And Lorna, I go back and forth, the best friend. So I'm, you know, not quite sure who's going to be in that role, but those are my
Lorna. I really liked Lorna's character, like him. Yeah. Clearly deep water there, but also a little chaotic. Like,
yes. Speaking of chaotic Scorpio energy, I feel like, you know, maybe a little more Gemini for her, but yeah, she's all over the place, but she makes a much more splash in book two. So mm-hmm.
yeah, well, good. Yeah. I mean, you have populated your town with interesting characters and I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens next. So,
thank you so much.
Yeah. And I just want to take the opportunity, and I feel like we've gotten to do this a lot lately because I've had some lovely folks reach out, but I just want to remind people, if you're listening and you're a writer and you write even adjacent to magic, shoot me an email. Let's chat.
So, yeah. Like my biggest thing is, especially, you know, if you're indie, like shoot your shot, like reach out to people, because the worst they can say is no. And I've been lucky that I've just been just gung-ho about like, I'm just going to see.
Yeah. And I think that's really what you have to do. Yeah. And I mean, the worst they can say is no. And I will mm-hmm. say this, like, if they say no to you, they're not going to then remember you as a horrible person who asked them to do something. They're probably just going to forget. So you're not even going to be like embarrassed later if you run into them, I promise.
Yeah. And, you know, remember, I kind of try to, you know, be on the mindset of like, you know, nothing is personal. So mm-hmm. if they say no, it doesn't mean that you're a bad writer or that they don't want to ever work with you again. It's just, you know, maybe their schedule's full, maybe something else.
Yeah. I mean, I've reached out to some folks that I would love to have on the show, and, you know, I've gotten no's and they're like, I would love to, but I don't have time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, thank you. That's honest. Thank you.
So. Absolutely. Yeah. Always reach out. You never know.
Yep. Awesome. Well, Ren, thank you so much. And thanks for this lovely book. If people need some cozy in the chaos, I highly recommend. And I can't wait for book two. And hopefully people will have picked up book one when they hear this. And mm-hmm. those book two will be magically there.
So, there that week. Yeah.
Love it. Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk again soon sometime.
Great. All right. Thank you.
Witch Lit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shinekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.